So there's this moment early in True Detective Season 1 where Rust Cole is riding shotgun with his partner Marty. Windows up, Louisiana sky looking like a dirty sponge. And Marty's trying to make small talk to make the hours of stakeouts feel a little less like slow death. Rust instead starts talking about consciousness as a tragic evolutionary misstep. It's actually a rather intense dialogue where Rust mentions that being a pessimist means he's bad at parties. And Marty responds with, "Well, let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either." Now, it's funny and a little horrifying all at once, kind of like watching someone light a cigarette at a gas station. And most people would hear this and probably think, yeah, that's pretty messed up. But if you listen past the edgelord vibe, what you're hearing is a man who's allergic to illusion. Now, Rust isn't trying to be edgy. He's just trying to be honest. And in a world where every conversation has been sandblasted smooth by a constant barrage of polite lies, that honesty feels kind of radioactive. So we've been trained to treat pessimism like it's as asbestos. Don't touch it or breathe it. Don't be near people who have it. But I think what Rust is doing in that car is closer to surgery. He's slicing into the polite fiction that existence is fundamentally good and progress is inevitable. And he's showing what happens when you look at the world without an Instagram filter. Which brings me here, because I think pessimism, true pessimism, not the sulking and whining type, it might be the last honest medicine that we've got. And not as a mood disorder, but as a lens. So the darkness you're told to avoid might not really be darkness at all. It might be only part of the room that isn't painted over in neon. And I think sometimes there's a light to be found in the darkness, if you're brave enough to go in there and look for it. If Rust Cole in that car felt like a punchline, the philosophy behind what he's saying, it's dead serious. And it comes from a long, bleakly luminous tradition. Schopenhauer, Mainlander, Chorin, and more recently, Mara van der Lucht. But let's stay with Rust a little bit longer, because I think the more you try to understand him, the more you start to understand why pessimism isn't just darkness for darkness sake. It's a way of seeing that can cut you open but make you more humane at the same time. Now, Rust Cole doesn't sneer at humanity from a safe distance. He autopsies it while still inside the body. So when he mutters something about time being a flat circle or consciousness being a tragic evolutionary mistake. It isn't some sophomore dorm room edginess. It's the residue of staring at the raw data of existence a little too long. He's done the math, and he's lost the appetite for consolation prizes. And that's precisely why he feels trustworthy. He's allergic to illusion. And that puts him in a long, bleakly luminous lineage. The philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer opened the 19th century by saying, essentially, existence is built on suffering. And if you understand that, compassion becomes your only defensible ethic. Emil Chorin followed in the 20th century, turning despair into something like an art form. He wrote paragraphs like knives cutting away anything that smells like hope's perfume. And now Mara Vanderloot in Dark Matters traces how pessimism has never really been, it's never really been about sulking, but about fidelity to the truth, however unflattering that truth may be. Now, she treats pessimism not as a mood, but as a philosophical methodology, a form of, well, let's say a form of intellectual hygiene in a world that's drunk on hope. And the irony is that by facing the worst, these thinkers found something better than optimism. They found clarity. And clarity is a strange creature. It doesn't coddle, but it can console. And it doesn't make the pain vanish, but it makes the pain make sense. And that's the beginning of real compassion. Not the TED Talk version, but the kind that comes from seeing everyone, including yourself, as another prisoner in the same burning building. All right. So here's where people get nervous. They think, okay, maybe Rust Cole makes for great television and Schopenhauer makes for great insomnia. But how does any of this help me pay my rent or stop my brain from spinning at 3 in the morning? That's a fair question. Because pessimism sounds impractical in a world that treats hope like an output multiplier. We're told that optimism, it'll get you the job, the relationship, the car, house, the life. Pessimism just gets your wrinkles. Except, take a look around. We've been mainlining positivity for decades, and most people are still anxious and lonely and broke. Now, our culture's version of hope is basically a motivational pyramid scheme. Keep visualizing and grinding. And, you know, just keep smiling while the house burns. This is fine. Everything's fine. And the billboards for this toxic positivity scheme they're everywhere. Good vibes only. Choose happiness, manifest abundance, live, laugh, love. It's like being mugged by a children's birthday clown. Now, real pessimism is different because it's not about predicting that everything will go wrong. It's about dropping the hallucination that everything is supposed to go right. And once you do that, weirdly, a lot of your suffering stops being personal. You stop treating setbacks like moral failures, and you start seeing them as conditions of the terrain. Maybe you stop thinking, why me? And you start thinking, of course me. This is what it means to be human. Now, that shift doesn't make life painless, of course, but it does make it less insulting. All right, let's take mental health. We are in an epidemic of anxiety, partly because we've been told, or when we've been sold, an impossible standard. Permanent, upward-only well-being. Now, pessimism, it reintroduces a much older, and I would suggest, much saner standard. Life as a cycle of difficulties punctuated by small reprieves. Now, the Buddhists had this figured out long before Instagram wellness culture showed up with its detox teas. To expect suffering is not to wallow in it. It's to meet it without panic. That's a psychological skill and not a mood. Same thing in relationships. Forced optimism says there's a perfect person out there, and if you're not blissfully happy living a perfect life, you're just a failure. A pessimistic clarity says every human is flawed, and love is two flawed people improvising on a slowly sinking ship. Now, that doesn't sound very romantic, but I think it's actually much kinder than the fairy tale. It lets you forgive and be forgiven. And it stops you from treating your partner like a defective product or something. And as far as work, well, pessimistic clarity, it helps there too. The cult, you know, this whole cult of follow your passion has left a whole generation exhausted and resentful because, unfortunately, passion doesn't always pay the electric bill. So, if you understand from the start that work under capitalism is mostly transactional, not a spiritual soulmate quest, you're a little less likely to feel betrayed. And of course, you can still aim for meaningful work, but you won't confuse a job description with a calling from God. And people tend to believe that pessimism is a hope killer, but it actually kills entitlement. It kills this fantasy that life owes you a storyline with a three-act structure and a happy ending. And once that's gone, you could start living the messy and unscripted thing you've actually got. And there's a relief in that. It's like stepping out of a rigged carnival game and realizing You don't have to win the giant stuffed panda to justify your existence. And here's the paradox. When you give up on the scripted happy ending, you're finally free to notice the unscripted moments of grace. Maybe a friend who shows up when they didn't have to, a night where the city goes quiet and you can hear your own thoughts, a laugh that comes out of nowhere like a flare in the dark. These things aren't, they aren't much by social media standards, but they're real and they're yours. And I think that's why thinkers like van der Lugt argued that pessimism isn't the enemy of hope, but it's precondition. If you want a hope that's more than advertising copy, you have to strip away the fake stuff first. There's a process to this. That's what Chorin meant when he said, we're never more disillusioned when our illusions come true. A clean despair is often healthier than a perfumed delusion. And from there, if any hope survives, it's a hope you can actually trust. Okay. Now, the good news, or maybe the bad news, depending on your taste, is that life is going to give you plenty of chances to practice. Nobody gets out of here without a heartbreak or a health scare, some kind of loss, a quiet night wondering what the hell is the point of doing anything. You don't have to look for the darkness because it's already on the schedule. Now, what pessimism offers is a way to greet it without pretending it's not there. And this isn't negativity. It's actually competence. All right. So if pessimism is a discipline, optimism is an industry. There's money in keeping you upbeat. Think about it. There's whole sectors of the economy depend on your belief that the next job or the next product, the next wellness retreat or whatever, the next swipe right is going to fix you somehow. If you stop believing that, entire marketing departments would collapse like wet cardboard. I mean, the self-help industry alone is worth billions. Manifest your dreams, good vibes only, and so forth. These aren't just slogans, they're sales funnels. And the most effective sales tactic ever invented is hope. So what this means is you're not buying the protein powder, you're buying the fantasy of the body you'll have in 3 months from now, allegedly. You don't buy the online course, you buy the future self who finally has their shit together. Hope is the subscription service you keep renewing, even though the package never really arrives. And this is why pessimism feels dangerous. It's not that it's wrong. It's because it interrupts the business model. So a person who accepts life's built-in chaos is ultimately a terrible consumer. They're not easily seduced by the next fix. They don't think they're one affirmation away from transcendence. They stop scrolling. They might even go for a walk without earbuds or their phone. And that's just not good for ad revenue, is it? So the allergy to negative thinking isn't really about your mental health. It's about protecting an economy that feeds on your dissatisfaction and your desperate attempts to medicate it. And we're all trying to medicate it one way or another. The moment you say, maybe things won't get better, you've opted out of a massive feedback loop of consumption. You've become, in the mildest, quietest way possible, a revolutionary of sorts. And this is also why workplaces love positivity trainings. A pessimistic employee is harder to exploit. They're less likely to volunteer for unpaid overtime in the name of team spirit. They're less likely to confuse their employer with a family. Pessimism in the workplace isn't toxicity. It's like an immune response. And this allergy runs deep because we tend to pathologize sadness and anger and doubt like they're communicable diseases. We even sanitize death, hiding it away in hospitals and nursing homes so the living won't get any ideas. We live in a culture where the weather isn't allowed to be gloomy, but people, well, the weather is allowed to be gloomy, but people aren't. Everything must be sunny with a chance of disruption. That's the real joke here. The most negative people I know are often the most compassionate, and they're often the most self-aware. They tend to be the ones who show up at 3 a.m. because they're not busy chanting love and light to themselves. They're not shocked when life hurts, so they're not repelled by other people's pain. Meanwhile, a lot of self-proclaimed positive folks, they bolt the moment your grief threatens to harsh their vibe. They don't want the shadow in the room. But pessimists already live with the shadow. They've set a chair for it at the table. And this is why thinkers like Schopenhauer and van der Lucht insist pessimism isn't a mood disorder, it's an ethic. You look at the world without the filter and you let that knowledge shape your behavior. So you become harder to fool, and paradoxically, you become easier to trust. You might still try to make things better, but you don't constantly lie to yourself about the odds. And that honesty itself is a kind of kindness. I think there's also a kind of dignity in and authenticity in pessimism. It doesn't demand an applause, and it doesn't need to be retweeted. It's private. It's almost ascetic. And in this world where every opinion is seen as a brand, I think a little unmarketable realism is actually refreshing. Pessimism as rebellion isn't about yelling at strangers online. It's about refusing to participate in the forced smile. Think of it as a quiet refusal to be gaslit by the culture. Now, none of this means you stop acting and stop caring or stop hoping. It just means you stop being conned. And the con works like this. If you're not happy, it's your fault for thinking the wrong thoughts. Buy the next thing, meditate harder, visualize harder, and so forth. It's the spiritual equivalent of payday loans. Now, pessimism cuts the cord. It says, look, this is the interest rate. This is the principal. And this is the reality. It's not fun, but it's clean. And once you are clean of the con, you get to decide what kind of hope you actually want to practice. Hope, not as a product, but as an act. And not as a prediction, but as a posture. Hope that's willing to actually get its hands dirty. Okay. So people hear pessimism and they assume that it leads straight to bitterness, like some kind of moral acid bath. But the opposite often happens. Once you stop expecting the universe to play nice, you stop taking its slaps so personally. And you start seeing other people not as competition or obstacles, but more like fellow travelers in the same bad weather. The bitterness drains out, replaced by something more durable. Solidarity. So Schopenhauer called compassion the only authentic ethic. And he didn't see it this way because he was sentimental, but because he recognized a hard truth, that suffering is the one experience we all share. This is pessimism's secret door into kindness. If you genuinely believe life is hard for everyone in one way or another, cruelty stops feeling satisfying. You don't have to like everyone. You just stop enjoying their pain. This isn't supposed to be a Hallmark card feeling. It's a kind of quiet decency that costs nothing but illusions. All right. So think about the people you actually trust in your life. They're rarely the ones peddling good vibes only malarkey. They're the ones who can sit with you in a hospital waiting room or on a cracked sidewalk at 2 a.m. because they're not allergic to your pain. They're not scared it'll rub off on them. That's the gift pessimism gives. An immune system strong enough to handle reality. Which means you can actually be present for other people instead of trying to fix or bypass or hashtag their misery. Chorin once wrote, it is not worth the bother of killing yourself since you always kill yourself too late. Now that sounds bleak, but under that dark humor is a strange consolation. You're still here. Everyone else is still here. We're all still fumbling around together. Absurd and temporary. And pessimism at its best isn't a death wish. It's a reminder of how fragile and therefore how precious everything is. This is where pessimism and hope actually meet. It's not the sugary hope of manifesting your dream yacht. No. It's the stubborn, hands-on, or dirty hands hope of people who know the odds and act anyway. Hope without illusions. It's the kind of hope that you see in a nurse's exhausted shift or a friend who keeps showing up to meetings even when the relapse seems inevitable. And it's the hope that Camus wrote about when he imagined Sisyphus smiling at the bottom of that hill. The rock didn't get lighter, but the moment still mattered anyway. I think the trick is not to romanticize despair, but to metabolize it. And I think that's what thinkers like Mara van der Lugt are arguing in her book, Dark Matters. Pessimism as a methodological lens for cutting through false brightness. So whatever light you do find is actually authentic. She isn't advocating self-pity. She's advocating lucidity. And that's a skill actually worth practicing. So this raises the question, how do you practice it without turning it into, or without you turning into a hermit who only speaks in bleak aphorisms? Well, start small and stop apologizing for noticing what's wrong. When a friend is suffering, don't reflexively try to cheer them up. Just sit with them instead and just listen. Stop forcing yourself to be grateful for every single thing all the time. Be honest about what's unbearable. It's okay. Honesty doesn't make things worse, but denial does. Another practice, try to diversify your emotional portfolio. Let yourself feel despair without trying to immediately fix it. Let yourself feel joy without treating it like a reward for good behavior. This isn't moral relativism. It's emotional realism. A Buddhist would call it equanimity, but pessimism just calls it Tuesday. I think you can also make a habit out of refusing the con. You know, when an ad or a guru or whatever promises you transcendence in three easy steps, say out loud, maybe not. When someone says, good vibes only, answer, I'm not sure reality got that memo. This isn't about being a contrarian for sport. It's about inoculating yourself against a culture that profits from your self-blame. And over time, that refusal changes you. You become harder to market to, harder to manipulate, You become harder to shame. You also become easier to be around because you're not demanding a performance of happiness from everyone else. And that's the compassion that pessimism grows. It's not the kind that tweets inspirational quotes. It's the kind that stays calm when the power goes out. Look, none of this is glamorous. You won't get a book deal for practicing pessimistic clarity, but you might get something better, which is a life that feels less like a scam. And you might even find a strange kind of peace, and not because the world is less chaotic, but because you've stopped pretending that it isn't. And here's the final irony. Once you accept the darkness, you start seeing small, unscripted bits of light you used to overlook. Maybe a neighbor's kindness, a kid's weird joke, the way late afternoon sunlight hits a filthy street and turns it to gold for 5 seconds. Now, they don't add up to salvation, but they add up to a life. And I think this is more than the marketing department of hope could ever deliver. Okay, short story time. Years ago, I met a guy at a bus stop late at night. He looked like he had been sleeping rough. And we started talking. Nothing profound. Just a couple of strangers killing time, waiting for a vehicle that was probably late. And out of nowhere, he said, "You know what keeps me going? I don't expect anything. I'm never disappointed. And sometimes life nonetheless still surprises me." And then he laughed like a dry, hoarse smoker's laugh. And the bus arrived. Now, I never saw him again, but I think about that moment every once in a while, because that was pessimism in the wild, not a philosophy lecture, just a guy who'd learned how to live without the con and found a little freedom inside the wreckage. That's really what I've been circling this whole time. Pessimism isn't an aesthetic. It isn't dressing in black and memorizing Chorin quotes. It's a survival skill. It's a way of walking through the burning building without inhaling more smoke than you have to. And I think it's what Rust Cole was practicing between crime scenes. It's what Schopenhauer was doing when he tried to make compassion the only honest ethic. It's also what Mara van der Lugt is describing in Dark Matters, showing that pessimism, at its best, is a clearing of the ground. So whatever grows there isn't a lie. But a clearing is really just the start, because you still have to live. And living inside clarity, it takes practice. And you don't have to run off to the woods or start screaming at strangers online to live this way. It starts smaller than that. So, before you buy the next life improvement gadget or sign up for whatever self-optimization cult is trending, ask yourself if it will still matter on your worst day. And if the answer is no, skip it. That single question alone can save you a fortune in money and time and dignity. It also helps you to show up with some kind of, it also helps you to show up without some kind of performance. When someone you care about is hurting, resist the reflex to deliver some pep talk or slap a motivational quote on their pain. Just sit down in silence, make tea or something. Half the suffering of modern life comes from this frantic need to constantly paste over cracks with positivity. Just standing there with someone is the crack. Just standing with someone in the crack is basically radical now. And there's this private stuff, the small, unsponsored rituals that keep your perception honest. Something like a nightly walk with no earbuds. Writing down one uncomfortable truth each morning. Reading a page of Chorin or Schopenhauer or van der Lucht instead of doom scrolling endlessly. And not to marinate in despair, but to keep your eyes clear. Another quiet shift, giving yourself permission to like things without always turning them into investments of hope. How about just enjoy a good day without demanding a lifetime of them? Enjoy a person without expecting them to complete you somehow. Maybe even try to enjoy work without expecting it to save you. I think that move from entitlement to appreciation is pessimism's unexpected little gift. And listen, none of this will make you immune to pain, but I think it can make you less surprised by it, less insulted by it, and therefore less likely to pass it on. And that's the real compassion hiding inside the bleak view. Okay, that's all I got today. Thanks for watching.